Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, providing emergency funding to nonprofit organizations during the pandemic. But up front, at any given time, there are more than 100,000 people waiting for an organ transplant. Wait times for transplants can vary, with the average time frame between 3 to 5 years. Now, people needing transplants must contend with the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. It has created a worse situation where there just aren't nearly enough donor organs available, and wait times, well, they're unpredictable. Joining us on today's program is Rick Haas. He's the Gift of Life Donor Program's Vice President in Clinical Services. Mr. Haas, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Dr. Michael Marvin is with Geisinger Health. He's a kidney and liver transplant surgeon. Dr. Marvin, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Sarah Reese has a personal story to tell. Her 4-year-old son, Zachary, is in need of a heart transplant. Ms. Reese, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about organ transplants, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sarah Reese, I want to start with you. Tell me about your son, Zachary. He's 4 years old, but he's in need of a heart transplant. Tell us a little bit about Zachary.
So our journey began about a year ago when Zachary was previously healthy, had never been to the pediatrician for anything other than his well-child checks, and he developed a double ear infection. So as a result of the double ear infection, his body developed this rare immune response called Kawasaki's disease, and it actually ended up destroying his coronary arteries. So we spent from the end of June through September in the ICU in Philadelphia at CHOP. And then from there, they decided that the best choice was to lift him for a heart just because of the destruction that the virus that he had contracted had done to his heart. They figured the best way to make it better was just to get him a new heart all around.
So how long has Zachary been waiting for a heart transplant?
So they listed him in August. So August 2nd of 2019, they listed him. And he was a status 1B at that point in time, not as critical as other kiddos would have been considered. So then at that point, we came back into the hospital in December. He was declining in health. His heart function was severely decreased, and he required a left ventricular assist device to be implanted into his heart to help his heart pump better. So at that point, they actually upped his status to a 1A.
So what's it been like waiting for a transplant? I mean, it's difficult to begin with. You know, I'm sure that day by day, you know, you're on edge all the time thinking, is this going to be the day that Zachary can get a heart? But what has it been like during this pandemic?
Well, it was a roller coaster ride to begin with, and now it's just, I try not even to think about the pandemic because, it's everywhere to begin with. So I just, you know, at first I would make the joke, you know, leave it up to my kids to get a heart transplant during a global pandemic. And then we ended up back in the hospital because he had a stroke. So we're actually in the hospital right now, and at this point, it's just, to me, the wait is just the same because I'm living in a hospital, so it's not like I'm out and about like everybody else is, or quarantined at home for that matter. I just got to keep kind of the faith that it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when the right heart becomes available, pandemic or not. So I try not to focus on the pandemic because it just kind of creeps into every other aspect of our lives at this point, that I just try to keep it off our roller coaster of transplants. But so if we were on the roller coaster before, we're now on the upside down roller coaster.
Now, Sarah Reese, your family lives in Delta in York County, and you're a nurse in Lancaster, so correct. Obviously from central Pennsylvania, but you're in the hospital in Philly right now?
Yes. Okay. So we've been here since the end of March. He had a stroke in the end of March, and we came here in an ambulance after that happened. So we've just been waiting here while he's recovering, you know, in hopes that it'll happen while we're here. But again, you know, we just don't know when.
Well, how is Zachary doing right now?
He's doing great.
Is he
cognitively completely intact, memory sharp. Physically, he is almost 100% back to his norm. It's incredible. Like, the neurologist had told me she was ecstatic with his progress, and the other doctors told me that she doesn't get ecstatic about much, so that we needed to be very happy that, you know, she was ecstatic about his progress.
Well, that's great to hear, and I'm sure everyone listening today will have him on their minds. But I want to turn to Dr. Marvin now. Doctor, I'm curious. We just heard one story, not necessarily related to the COVID-19 pandemic, but I am curious, in Geisinger, in the Geisinger system, you're a kidney and liver transplant surgeon. Have there been transplant surgeries? Have you been performing any surgeries during this pandemic?
Yes, we have. We initially slowed down just because of concerns over what might be the sort of the prevalence or the incidence of the virus in our area. We didn't have, thankfully, not been hit the way New York City has, or New York in general has. And so while we initially were very hesitant to do transplants, we realized that if you think about a patient, let's say on dialysis, who is going to in-center dialysis, meaning 3 days a week, they travel to a center where there are other patients, you know, in the facility, one would think that that risk might actually be much more than getting a transplant and staying home, because you're not as exposed to, you know, multiple patients and whatever they were doing during the quarantine. So that was one aspect of it. We also were very selective when we did say yes to a transplant in which recipients and which donors. You know, there's a very, very big range of the baseline health of the recipient, as well as the quality of the donor organ. And we initially just picked very good quality donor organs, as well as relatively healthy recipients that were definitely in need and would do poorly on dialysis. So there was a lot of judgment that went into the decisions. That's regarding kidney, but when you talk about liver, typically you don't get a liver transplant until you're very, very sick. And the risk of waiting and saying no to a liver that could be life-saving in the very, very short term was those risks were far outweighed by the risk of getting a virus that may not even be present. So, you know, there were major life and death decisions that we had to make, and it really was a judgment call, and it was a matter of weighing risks.
Well, I mean, that's typical, isn't it, when there's a transplant being considered? But what has changed for you in particular? And I'm going to ask the same question about from Rick Haas in just a moment about overall. But for Geisinger and you in particular, what's changed during this pandemic?
Well, initially, during the pandemic, we were not anywhere close to as busy as we had been. We were a very rapidly growing program. We performed 90 kidney transplants last year, and we were on target for probably 100 or more this year. And then this happened, and the risks just became, you know, overwhelming, and it was really a matter of unknown. And in kidney transplants in particular, like I said, there is always dialysis. And so there was always, you know, no one had any idea what would happen if to patients that had their immune system suppressed for prevention of rejection or treatment of rejection. No one really knew what was going to happen in, you know, the January, February, March timeframe. As the data came out and as we became more aware and had more experience, we were able to start, you know, opening up our transplant program again to utilize some of the life-giving organs and life-saving organs that Rick has been, and his team have been able to provide us with, and that we weren't able to be used. And I'm sure he can provide you with a lot more detail about how there were organs that were used in the past that weren't because of this crisis. And we've actually had recipients that said they were too afraid to get a transplant. They were offered an organ, and they said no because they were too worried.
Wow. Rick Haas, you're the Gift of Life Donor Program's Vice President of Clinical Services. Is Geisinger's situation typical? Because from what I understand, across Pennsylvania and across the nation, that there have been some real changes in organ transplants during this time. What are some of them?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I think as Dr. Marvin said, I think one of the important lessons that we've been learning from this is that I think donation and transplant are uniquely positioned to respond effectively to a pandemic. These are the types of decisions that clinicians like Dr. Marvin make every day, pandemic or no pandemic, on risk and evaluation of a donor organ for a particular recipient. I mean, that's right up their expertise, and I think this pandemic really highlighted how the donation and transplantation systems came together to make sure that we could still provide hope for those patients who are waiting. You know, Sarah so eloquently talked about Zach's condition, and you know, at Gift of Life, we take that responsibility of being the voice for those patients who are waiting and made sure that we were able to adapt to all the different changes that were going on in the acute care hospital setting to be able to continue to provide donation services in the area. You know, and that includes making sure our staff who are, you know, coordinating these donations in the ICU have proper PPEs, making sure that we're appropriately screening the donors for COVID to make sure that those organs are going to be safe for transplant. And then during the coordination process, really making sure, you know, all the transportation and logistics that go into it on a daily basis, that we can do that in a responsible and safe manner as well. So we have seen a little bit of the slowing of the donation, and most of that really hasn't been because of COVID itself. It's been, I think, what hospitals across the country are seeing are less admissions to the hospitals for things such as stroke and heart attacks, which are usually the people who end up being potential organ donors. So
yeah, I wanted to bring that up because now I saw an article, and all this was a few weeks old, so maybe the statistics have changed a little bit, that said nationwide at least a third, that the organ donations were down by at least a third, and for just the reason that you cited, and I'll add to that, that aren't seeing as many heart attacks, aren't seeing as many strokes of people coming into the emergency room. We talked about this in our program yesterday. I don't quite know where those people are going if they have those serious illnesses. But also, because people are staying home, not as many deaths due to accidents, car crashes, or even due to violence. So those are all factors. Would you agree with that third? I saw one figure that in the Philadelphia area, it may be less than that, but it is down substantially, though, isn't it?
You know, the trauma causes of death for organ donation is really makes up the smallest proportion of donors. And, you know, we haven't necessarily seen that. It's really the more the strokes and the heart attacks having decreased. But with that said, you know, it really varies across the country. And while it's slowed down here, and I think in the Northeast, you know, from Boston, New York, and the Philadelphia area, if you look at the country, we still have more donors in 2020 than we did at this same time in 2019. And I think that speaks volumes to our ability to coordinate these types of things during the pandemic. Now, with that said, there have been less transplants, and I think Dr. Marvin really went over that risk-benefit in trying to the donor selection and the recipient selection process. And I think we should see that hopefully in over the next few weeks and months starting to increase again. But I can tell you, families who have suffered the loss of a loved one, it's been a very challenging time for them. Many times, you know, when their loved one dies in the hospital in the ICU, they're no longer, you know, able to be there with them. And so that's, provided some challenges for our staff in trying to counsel those families and have conversations with them about donation when we're no longer doing that sometimes in person and having to adapt and do that over phone. But we've been amazed and humbled, really, by donor families. Still during this pandemic, in the worst possible time of their lives, they've been able to say yes to donation and reach out to help another family, like the Reese family. So,
Sarah, I heard you kind of react when Rick said that there are more organs than this time last year. What were you thinking? What was your reaction to?
It was just kind of like, wow. I mean, it's impressive, you know.
Would you have thought that? I wouldn't have.
No, that's why I was like, wow.
Yeah, really. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about organ donation during the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. Our guest today, Rick Haas, is the Gift of Life Donor Program's Vice President of Clinical Services, Geisinger Kidney and Liver Transplant Surgeon Dr. Michael Marvin. Sarah Reese is a York County native. She works as a nurse in Lancaster. Her 4-year-old son, Zach, is waiting for a heart transplant at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I want to get into some of the other changes or things that are different during this pandemic. Dr. Marvin, I'll come to you with this one. I understand that an organ recipient or a would-be organ recipient cannot test positive for COVID-19. Is that correct?
Yes, we would not consider transplanting someone with the active virus. There are so many unknowns about it, and there's no way we would move forward with in the setting of a positive recipient.
What about an organ donor? They have to be tested for corona as well, and if they test positive, then what?
At this point, it is considered a contraindication, although I just read an article, an opinion piece, that suggested that maybe that shouldn't be the case. The risk of virus in the blood is reported to be roughly 15%, but I don't think there's any way we could rely on that data at the current time. And so I think that in general, a COVID-positive donor would be considered an inappropriate donor. But I would leave that to Rick, because he's seeing, you know, if you have someone who's dying waiting for a heart or a lung or a liver, and, you know, you're talking about potentially a 15% chance of getting some virus that 99% of the people survive, you might say it's worth the risk. Now, obviously, it's a different patient population when you have someone getting an organ transplant receiving immunosuppressive drugs, drugs that limit their immune system's ability to fight. But still, if you know you have essentially 100% chance of dying without the organ, some surgeon, parent, family member, family might say, you know what, I'll take that risk. And that's the judgment call that we often have to make in combination with the families. Like I said, we've offered organs to potential recipients, and they've said no because they're worried. And they always win that argument because, you know, in reality, we work for them. So they get to decide ultimately if they're going to accept the risk or not. Rick would probably be able to tell us even more. Rick, have you placed any of those organs?
Yeah, right now, we have not placed any organ from a donor who is a potential donor who has tested positive. And, you know, I don't think we know yet enough about the virus, and I don't think people are willing to take that risk. But I think in the future, as we learn more and more literature is published, that may be a possibility. And if you think about other viruses, such as hepatitis C, and HIV. We are now utilizing organ donors from those types of donors and transplanting, in the case of HIV, patients who have HIV. And for hepatitis C, not only transplanting hepatitis C candidates, but also treating candidates, and Dr. Marvin has had a protocol and has been very effective at doing this, and then treating the recipients for hepatitis C. And so while today it may be a rule out, I think as we learn more, I would suspect that risk-benefit may weigh in favor of actually proceeding at some point in the future.
Well, Rick, I think you hit on something that is very important, not just about organ donation and transplants, but about the whole COVID-19 virus itself, is that this is a new virus that, you know, just 6 months ago we didn't know existed. And so we are learning almost day by day more about this virus. So it fits right into what you're talking about, that we don't know whether that's something that can occur or can happen safely, or the patient, the person who is the recipient, can be healthy. Now, there have been some other things, though, as well. And I'm going to preface this by saying that things are changing all the time. But so, Rick, you tell me whether this condition still exists, but that there has been a real shortage of blood during this pandemic, that there are fewer donors out there, and that there are, you know, I keep hearing here in central Pennsylvania, we need some blood donations. We need some blood donors out there. Is that still an issue? Because transplant recipients are usually, depending on depending on the organ being transplanted, are in great need of blood transplants. Excuse me, transfusions.
Yeah, and I'll let Dr. Marvin handle the clinical on the recipient side. I can tell you, you know, blood donations, we work with a tissue processor who also is a blood bank, and you know, the number of blood donations is down. People aren't as, you know, obviously being quarantined, aren't going out to their donation centers as frequently or as often. So I know there is a need and a shortage of blood at the same time. In terms of availability for transplant, a skilled transplant surgeon like Dr. Marvin may not need as much blood as they once did doing a liver transplant, but I think he'd probably be able to answer that question much better than I.
Dr. Marvin?
Thanks, Rick. Yes, the blood donations have been down, and Geisinger actually was prepared for an algorithm as to how we would conserve blood should we actually get into one of these highly limited resource times. Thankfully, it hasn't happened. I think because we've shut down a lot of the routine surgery that would occasionally require a unit or two of blood that was more routine. Kidney transplant recipients, I would say, rarely get blood transfusions. They might, I would say, less than 5% of patients that get a kidney transplant need a blood transfusion. Liver transplants are very different, but we've done patients who have had liver transplants with no blood transfusions at all. And then there are some that need quite a bit. It all depends on the level of liver failure the patient has. Sometimes patients essentially in extremis with a liver that's completely not working, and those patients often need many, many units of blood and blood products. But there are others that are still offered a liver transplant who may have a tumor, but their liver function is actually pretty good, and they at times need maybe a couple of units at most. And so, thankfully, because of what I believe is the shutdown and the limiting of routine elective surgery, while there is a shortage of blood donations, I think we haven't hit that critical stage where blood hasn't been available when needed, at least here at Geisinger.
Would you say that the reduction in blood donations is due to the pandemic, that so many people don't want to go, first go out of the house, and secondly, go to a position, a situation where they're going to be giving blood where there will be other people?
Yes, I mean, of course, that's one of the factors, but also a lot of the blood drives have been canceled as well.
Yeah.
So you know that is another there's lots of reasons why blood donations are down.
Also, something else to be considered when we're talking about organ transplants is, you know, this is not the kind of surgery that it's not an outpatient surgery, obviously. It's not something where an organ is transplanted and the patient goes home. That very often the patient is the recipient is in the ICU, may need a ventilator. Now, very early on when we didn't know how many COVID-19 patients we would have in Pennsylvania, there was a real, you know, cut back on those elective surgeries or scheduled surgeries. I know hospitals like to refer to them as cut back on those, you know, trying to save as much bed space as possible. What about today, since we haven't had as many as was anticipated? Is this an issue, Rick, where bed space, ICU space during the COVID-19 pandemic, there's a shortage of it for those who may be getting organ transplants?
You know, it really has been different across, you know, the areas that we serve. So we serve Eastern PA, basically State College East, Southern New Jersey, and the state of Delaware. And so depending upon which hospital you are and which hot zone you might be in, it varies tremendously. But for the most part, I think hospitals are beginning to resume their elective procedures. And I think, you know, they planned well for the pandemic response. You know, we're positioned to have enough beds and have enough ventilators. I don't think we saw that in any of the areas. Now, that doesn't mean we didn't see a number of deaths that have increased. You know, we saw about a 50. We get a call on every death that occurs in that geographic area that I described, and we saw a 50% increase in the number of deaths called into our organization, and the majority of those were due to COVID. It is here, and it has hit the hospitals, but I think the acute care hospitals have responded extremely well, and hopefully with all the, you know, social distancing and other things that have been enabled us to really do this in a responsible way.
So it sounds as if things are much better than anticipated. You know, if you're in Sarah's position and Zach's position, you're still waiting. But overall, it sounds as if things are better than maybe anticipated a month and a half ago. So your message would seem to be one that would you could make even during a period when we didn't have a pandemic, is to make people aware of donating and organ donation. Correct, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the message for Sarah and folks like Zach is to have hope that, you know, there's a group of dedicated people here working on your behalf day in and day out to make sure that we can offer donation opportunities for families and provide that gift of life to those patients who so desperately need it. We, you know, we have 5,000 patients just like Zach who are waiting for a transplant in our area, over 100,000 people nationwide. Unfortunately, 20 people die every day who don't get that second chance. So there's a huge supply and demand imbalance. And luckily, we live in an area in our area that we cover that has led the nation in donation for the past 12 years. And it's because of the giving nature of the folks that we serve, as well as the, you know, we serve 123 acute care hospitals who, you know, during this pandemic didn't forget about organ donation, and many have commented it was the silver lining for them that at least they were able to offer donation and transplant to patients while they were, you know, meeting all the different challenges. So hopefully our message is one of hope Please go out and register to be an organ donor.
We have gotten several questions, though, from listeners about cost and who pays for transplants. Rick, what about that?
Yeah, for donation, there is no cost to a donor family. All that is borne by the Gift of Life organization. There's no cost whatsoever to donate.
What about for recipients? I mean, this can be an expensive procedure.
So for recipients, all of that is worked on before a patient gets on the list. All insurance companies or most insurance companies will cover transplantation. For kidney transplant in our area, about roughly 60% of the transplants are covered by Medicare. We will take all insurances that will allow patients to come to our area. Transplants or insurance is a state granted entity in general, other than Medicare. So every state has a different insurance, may have different insurance plans, and so there are plans from New York that may not allow patients to come to Geisinger. But typically, insurance companies will cover the cost of transplantation, and that includes the donor organ. Mm.
Sarah, I'm going to leave this segment with you. And, you've heard our conversation. I know that this has been the front of your mind for the past year or so. So what are you thinking going forward, that hope that Rick talked about just a few minutes ago? What are your days like as you're hoping that this is the day that Zach gets a heart?
I just have to stay positive, because if I stay positive, then he stays positive. And just hope that, when it's the right time and the right heart, that it will happen.
Sarah Reese, thank you very much for being with us today. And like I said, all our prayers and thoughts go out with you and your family and Zach especially.
Thank you.
Rick Haas is the Gift of Donor Program's Vice President of Clinical Services, and Dr. Michael Marvin, Geisinger Kidney and Liver Transplant Surgeon. Thank all of you for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much. Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and if you would like some more information on coronavirus, COVID-19, transplants, a lot of other issues, go to WITF's Transforming Health. It's at transforminghealth.org. It's a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Just want to follow up quickly on our last conversation. A number of people have sent emails asking about blood donation. They've mentioned the American Red Cross, that they have been booked. There are other places to donate blood. In fact, I've given blood to the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. If you would like to donate, and I think that is a good thing to do, as we do have this blood shortage, that you probably can find a way to do it and have it done safely. So continue looking, because it is very important during this pandemic. The Foundation for Enhancing Communities and the United Way of the Capital Region have teamed up to establish a Community Response Fund partnership to provide emergency funding to local nonprofit organizations. Joining us is Janice Black, President and CEO of the Foundation for Enhancing Communities. Janice Black, good to hear from you again.
Thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
And Tim Fatzinger, President and CEO of the United Way of the Capital Region. Tim, always good to hear from you, too.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Okay, let me start with a basic question. What is the Community Response Fund Partnership? Janice?
The partnership evolved when Tim and I spoke and decided that because we serve the same community, area nonprofits and individuals, that we would work together to bring about fundraising to be able to respond to all the needs that are coming out in regards to folks being out of work and needing food, etc. So that was how it started, and we're so happy that we did it.
How has it gone so far? I mean, we're a little more than 2 months into this. How has the fundraising part of it gone, and how has it gone for being able to provide some emergency funding to those nonprofits?
So far, we've raised about $150,000, with more coming that I know of. Tim and some other folks from the United Way served on a committee with us. We had our first fundraising round about 2 weeks ago and gave out $60,000 in grants, and we are going to have another round of grant making on the 28th. There are many, many nonprofits that have applied, and we want to continue this rolling grant round happening.
Well, give us a sense of how nonprofits are faring during this pandemic.
I can tell you that they are in need of money to help pay for their staff. They are in need for money to help pay for what their clients need, whether it be food or clothing or some kind of treatments or whatever it was that they were helping them with before the COVID hit. They're in great need to be able to continue those services. And all of that is demonstrated in the applications that we received from them and are still receiving from them. But I think Tim and I agree that this is a time when we really need to think about basic needs and to respond to those things that we hold true just to exist in our lives. Wouldn't you agree, Tim?
Oh, absolutely. I think the greatest needs we see, Scott, right now are rent assistance, housing. We see utility assistance needed by individuals, and obviously food. But it's also the support systems behind that the agencies need to be able to continue to provide those to the people that are in greatest need right now.
You mentioned housing, and I don't want to push the other needs to the side, but this may surprise some people, but I don't know, maybe not. I have heard that from several people and organizations throughout this pandemic that housing is by far, I had at least one person say that housing by far is the number one need of so many people, and by that, you know, being able to pay rent, being able to pay mortgages, that kind of thing. Would you agree with that, or are we kind of equal in some of these other needs?
Well, we work with 211 contact helpline. So just on a mere fact of call basis of individuals calling that service looking for services, the number one ask as of right now is for help with housing. So just based on those call numbers, from individuals, we see that as the number one need that people are reaching out for that can't find services or are struggling to find help in that area.
I spoke to Ann Gwinnan yesterday from Downtown Daily Bread, and she said that it's just an amazing need that people are showing from the homeless population in regards to housing.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, you have many people, so many people who have lost their jobs, and so many people who are in a situation where they don't have income coming in, or at least the kind of income that they're used to coming in, maybe for the first time in their adult lives, and they've never been in this situation, probably don't even know where to go. So considering that housing is probably their biggest expense in a month, that it would tend to make sense that those are all reasons that contribute to why so many people have housing needs. What about some of the other things? I mean, food is the one that gets so much attention. Are we seeing an increase in the need for food?
Absolutely. I know that we've had many applications from organizations that have small food banks. They're working with the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, but the need is so great that they are exhausted and they need to get more. And I've talked to Joe Arthur, and I know Tim has too, and the need has just been huge. So I know, Tim, you know a little bit more about that than I do with regards to more of the food needs.
Yeah, and it's typically, like, you see the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank's doing an excellent job. Salvation Army's doing an excellent job. But also it's those smaller organizations, as Janice mentioned, that the populations that they're serving, too, their typical sources for getting food have been diminished or they're more difficult to get to. So we need to continue to support those larger efforts, but it's also the small food pantries, those areas we don't think about that are in great need, too, in each of those areas. So I think that, to you, as you mentioned, Scott, that economic impact is we've added a whole new audience to those for those folks that are unemployed or they're laid off at this point, in addition to those areas which we were serving before. So it really is, it's kind of doubled the need in that area, if not tripled it.
I just said that food has gotten a lot of attention, and I'm talking mostly about from the media. And, you know, it's one of the first things that people think of when they want to donate and help other people is that the being able to provide food for them to eat. We mentioned housing being a great need. Is there an area that is not getting the kind of attention, a need that is not getting the kind of attention that maybe it should?
Well, I think one of the things we see is on the same lines as utility assistance, too. Now, I know lots of the utility companies have provided waivers or there's time frames that the folks don't have to be able to pay right now. But come the end of that waiver time frame, they're going to have full bills that are due to them. So that's another area. So think about just our daily expenses that we have. As you mentioned, Scott, there's that housing expense, rent, utility, food, but also you kick into everything else we need is child care, things of that nature. Those are all kind of areas that those basic needs, as we mentioned before and as Janice mentioned, they come into play even more when income drops or there's a lack of income. So, and they become magnified even greater. So I would say that other area that we've seen in that top three is really that utility assistance. Even if they're getting at the moment a waiver or they don't need to pay them, the bills are going to come due very soon on those because they can only waive those fees for so long.
Mm. Tim Fatziger is president and CEO of the United Way of the Capital Region. Janice Black, president and CEO of the Foundation for Enhancing Communities. Thank you very much for being with us today. For those who may want to help, what can they do?
They can go to tfec.org. And right there is a place for them to donate to the COVID-19 Community Response Fund. When those funds come in, they will be granted out by the committee made up of folks from both the United Way and the Foundation. And in a few days, we'll be doing that grant making again, as I said earlier. So it's never too late to give in any amount.
Janice Black and Tim Fatziger, thank you very much for all you're doing, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott, for the opportunity.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, you know, it's a big day tomorrow. 143 Day. Are you familiar with 143 Day? It's a day of kindness, and the day of kindness is designated by the state. 143 was a code that Mr. Rogers used to have. 143, the number of letters in I love you. And so tomorrow is, it's also the 143rd day of the year. I know that 2020 has felt like it's gone on forever. But yes, it is only the 143rd day of 2020. 143 day here in Pennsylvania. We're going to have an encore Smart Talk tomorrow. This is from 2 years ago. It was the 50th anniversary of the premiere of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on television, and we broadcast from the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh, and had a lot of people on the program that were involved in the production of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, knew Mr. Rogers very well, including Mr. McAfeely, and that's coming up on tomorrow's program. We'll have that encore program for 143 day program. That's coming up 143 day tomorrow. So if you greet someone with happy 143, that's what you're talking about. The coronavirus is affecting each and every one of us. It's made connecting with friends and neighbors more challenging. That's why Transforming Health's Kira McGuire has been collecting stories from frontline workers to high school seniors. You know, everyone has a story to tell. Transforming Health's Coronavirus Diaries airs tonight at 8 on WITF-TV. We're joined by Kira McGuire, Transforming Health host and producer. Kira, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell me a little bit about the Coronavirus Diaries. Where'd the idea come from, and what kind of stories have you collected?
Sure. So basically, when this whole thing hit, we had to kind of think about how I could continue to produce and be able to collect people's stories and be able to document this time. So I had to think outside the box and try to figure out how to get those interviews. So I settled on Zoom. So we were doing some interviews through Zoom, and then I was asking these participants to keep video diaries, just using their cell phone, kind of documenting their days, how they've been impacted, just really keeping everything very real and being able to see what people are going through. So I was able to speak with EMTs, nurses, teachers, high school seniors, folks from the recovery community, folks from the disability community. So we have a lot of different perspectives that we were able to gather and we'll be able to share in the show tonight.
So what's your takeaway from being able to hear from so many different people?
You know, I think it's really interesting. It's a really tough time, obviously, for so many. We've been impacted in different ways, some more seriously than others. But every single person is going through this together. So it's a shared experience. And everybody that I talk to, kind of the takeaway is, yes, we're all going through this together, and we might be impacted in different ways, but it's separating us in many ways this time, but at the same time bringing us together because we're all concerned about the same thing. We're all trying to kind of fight this virus together. So separating us while also connecting us is kind of what I've taken away from this time.
You mentioned the different backgrounds of the people who kept these video diaries and will be in the program tonight. But it seemed to me that, you know, from watching the show, that I did get an opportunity to watch it, that some of those frontline heroes, the EMTs, the nurses, that they seem to provide a few more of the diaries. In fact, let's listen to from the show itself. Let's hear from a couple of them right now. Susie, Joe, can you play Susie for us? Okay, Joe. All right. Well, Joe is the board operator back at the station, and I guess he doesn't have Susie. Well, tell me about Susie, if you would, Kira.
Sure. Susie is she's a palliative care nurse. So normally she's working with people who are, you know, seriously gravely ill. So she, unlike many of us, has been kind of trained to deal with very serious situations and a lot of emotion. But still, in Susie's diary, you can see that this virus has hit her in a way that her normal job does not. And she's feeling very worried about the situation, very worried about her own health in addition, and the PPE that she's been provided with, not because of her organization, but just because it's a crazy time that no one was kind of expecting. So the PPE that she was provided with, she is concerned about. So in her soundbite, you would hear her talking about that and how she's just, you know, worried about what's to come.
You know, one of the big changes, and you feel so bad for them, high school seniors that mm-hmm. are not getting they're missing a third of their senior year, missing graduation, missing prom. All those things that traditionally, you know, something that a high school senior, a person remembers for the rest of their life. Olivia in the Northeastern School District was one. Tell me about Olivia.
Yeah, Olivia is, you can tell when you watch the video diary, a super bright girl. So just a great attitude, a great personality, very bright future ahead of her, it's clear. But yes, she has worked very hard throughout her high school career and was really looking forward to a lot of things that were coming her way, you know, kind of as a reward for all of this work that she's put into her high school career and send-off into her college career. And yes, it's these things have been canceled. So in Olivia's diary, we were actually kind of able to come along on that journey with her. We had her doing diaries before the school closure announcement came about. So I was able to reach out to her when it was announced that schools would continue to stay closed for the rest of the year. I was able to reach out to her and ask her to record a video diary at that time so that you can really feel that emotion and see what that news was like for her. So it's eye-opening to see how it impacts so many and really did take a toll on high school seniors for sure.
Well, Kira, as I said, I got an opportunity to watch the program. Excellent program, as always. Kira McGuire is WITF's Transforming Health host and producer. The show is Transforming Health's Coronavirus Diaries. It airs tonight at 8 on WITF-TV. Kira, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Coming up tomorrow on Encore Smart Talk, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. We'll be talking about Mr. Rogers. And that was from the Pittsburgh Heinz History Center. Coming up on tomorrow's program, 143 Day. So be sure to tune in.